Hi, this is Paul. I just watched the video with Jonathan Peugeot and Sevilla King, and I'm so excited! I gotta talk about it. I don't have time to make a PowerPoint. I got all these other things I gotta do this week, but I gotta talk about this video. It was so good! It was so good all the way through, I cannot talk about it. So, here we go. Now, a number of you have made comments about sound level. Sound level is a perpetual problem with my process. So, I'm gonna try out some new things to maybe do better. Part of the difficulty I have with this is that when I'm playing multiple videos on YouTube have different sound levels. And because I don't do any post-production, I can't really equalize them. So I'm going to try to pay a little more attention to that because I am sensitive to that because some of you only listen to audio. And if I'm going on ranting and raving loud, and then the person sounds like this, it's really frustrating for the listener, and I get that. But I've tried to do better with this video, so it's only one video I'm talking about. And again, I'd love to comment on the whole video, but I don't have so much time. I think this first section hits on a whole bunch of things that I've been thinking about. And again, this sort of this convergence of conversations, I really feel like in the last few weeks, things have been hitting a new level. So here we go.
It's so much of your content, but a lot, ironically, a lot of what you and Paul, you know, there are things that you and Paul discussed the other day that actually rose to the surface as points that I could connect with Piercing probably as well as anything. Mm-hmm. And
now I haven't really followed. People always call me. I haven't really followed her channel that closely. I've started dabbling in the book, and I've liked some of the book. But when she taught her description of metaphysics of quality. Now, Sevilla and I have had a previous conversation. I'll put the link to that in here. You know, I'm starting to get my mind wrapped around that. I remember Verveke making a comment in one of the comments about Neoplatonism, and I really get that. And so this was really helpful, this video, for helping me understand where Persig's metaphysics of quality is coming from and how that relates into the conversation. And I think her description of it here and where this goes, and actually later in the video that I probably won't get to unless I decide to blow out my time frame this afternoon and talk for 2 hours, but let's hear it.
I want to just, you know, I had gone through an introduction to the metaphysics of quality in that second video I did, so I don't want to go into it too much because it's there. But the metaphysics of quality is a philosophy that reintroduces value as the element, you know, like in subject to object and scientific and materialistic, there's no room for value, you know, yeah, in the actual rational framework.
And that's something that's hugely important. I was just re-listening to, this is a video that I have real problems with because all the Pangburn videos, their volume is so low that I have to really adjust my settings to use those videos. But I was re-listening to Jordan Peterson and Matt Dillahunty. And now, after everything I've learned over the last year and a half, I listen to that video, and it's like I'm watching, you know, in the Matrix when they're looking at the green, and we're all sitting there, it's like, oh, you can't see anything, and they're seeing everything going on, because I felt like that when I was looking at that video, because it was like these Peterson was laying out these arguments that I probably only half understood a year ago, and now I'm listening to him, I'm like, yep, and Dillahunty talks, it's like, nope. And this point right here about there's no value. Where's my cell phone stand? I got to default to the water bottle. This is not Taylor's water bottle. This is my water bottle. You see me drinking from it always. The value, and this is where actually when Jordan Peterson was talking to Sam Harris, when they're talking about Elton John's water cup, or Elvis's the guitar, that's what they were getting at, is where is the value of Elton John's water cup or Elvis's guitar or a guitar that was signed by Elvis? Where is that value? And you might say, well, that value is in the subjective, yeah, and then Sam Harris wanted to say the intersubjective, but the point that Sevilla is making here is the point that Piercing is making, is that in terms of the materialistic system, there is no value. And this is part of the reason why, you know, when I heard Dan Dennett on Unbelievable, he snuck in, there's matter and information. It's like, whoa, dude, that's not just a little aside here. That's huge. It's like if this water bottle, if you go to the moon and you find this water bottle, yeah, information is really important because it's like, I recognize this water bottle. You can buy this at Costco. They're a really good deal. And what's it doing on the moon? Because yeah, Costco wasn't around in the 70s, and this water bottle wasn't around in the 70s with this brand. And information is a really big deal. And if you're just going to sneak that into your worldview, it's like, where does that information come from? Because again, what we're dealing with a lot is this separation of the world between matter and mind. And this is what a lot of the Owen Barfield stuff is going to get at, the inside and the outside. And by the way, Unbelievable had a conversation with Mark Vernon and Malcolm Guite on Owen Barfield and C.S. Lewis. And I thought I was going to do that video next, but weekends I'm really busy. And Monday, yesterday was my 31st anniversary with my wife, so I didn't make any videos because we just had fun. And so today it's like back in the office, but I've got all this stuff I got to do, and the whole week is like jam-packed, but I got to make a video because this video was so good. So it even bumped up the Mark Vernon, Malcolm Guite video. And so this business about there being no value in the materialistic conception, that's exactly right. And kind of the kludge that has been that the materialists make is to say, well, subjects introduce that value, but what that does is that means that the value has no ontology. There's no fixedness to the value. The value only comes from people because they have to drink water, and so I have this water bottle. So that's the only place the value comes from. And it's like, what if value itself, and that's what I'm slowly understanding by this metaphysics of quality. I start watching these channels. I mean, first I couldn't pronounce John Vervaeke's name. Before that, I couldn't pronounce Jonathan Peugeot's name. Now I can't remember Savilla King's name. And you got all these issues going on in Vanderclay's dull, leaky brain. But bit by bit, I learn, and it's like, yeah, you know what? That's a huge problem, and you would have thought someone would notice it. Well, someone did notice it, but we as human beings have a huge problem in learning stuff. It takes a while for us to learn stuff. So, okay, back to the talk.
What you say is, no, there is, because it's ensconced in this greater value, and I think, and that's...
And that's what you have, in a sense. So a big part of where this goes is what we mean by the word God and what we mean by the value divine, okay? Because God is not a name. God is a being. Let's use that word because God is not a thing. Because we usually talk about created things as things. God is a being in three persons in the Christian theology and so on and so forth. And so obviously value is not a problem for a classical theistic position, because value is coming from someplace, just like mind is coming from someplace, just like, and value is really important, because one of the things that I referenced in a recent video about Vervaeke is that when I listen to John talk, and listen just about any conversation now, I'm so attuned to telos. What is the end? What is the goal? What are we reaching for? And so often I listen to these conversations and say, we have a sense of what we want, but we can't articulate it. We can't just plain say it. We not only can't we fully know what we're reaching for, we can't even rough draft it. We can maybe do a little A-B testing. This is sort of like Sam Harris's idea of good and better. Okay, so starvation in the desert is not good. Having a water bottle in the desert is better. Good. But, and that's give us a little bit of A-B testing down below within this frame. But this is where you get into, well, we don't have any stars to navigate by, partly because in the secular world, we have these buffered selves, and we are skeptical about knowing that which is beyond what we have encapsulated with our five senses, and then five senses plus reason, let's say. That would be the worldview of Matt Dillahunty or Sam Harris or a materialist, all right? Now, when you start saying information, well, baby, you're just a little step away from revelation. It's a sign that your house is about ready to fall. Anyway.
It's very similar to what Pearson would say. He would say that the metaphysical quality is value creating the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And
And when you listen to her talk about value so often, you can almost just swap in God. And a little bit later, we're going to talk about why we're so bashful about talking about God and why we so much would rather talk about value. But let's keep going.
And I want to just briefly mention one thing about his philosophy that I think makes it a little bit more apparent. So when Phaedrus is the character in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and what he is he's the original Pirsig before Pirsig had electroshock therapy for what was diagnosed as schizophrenia. And Pirsig is really brilliant, you know. So he's often this.
Just by the way, because I'm ADHD and I can't stop but put in a tangent here, I rewatched the movie about David Foster Wallace, and I've been reading that book about him. Very interesting about brilliance. And it's sometimes when I feel I'm dumb because I had to listen to a video 5 times before I got it through my thick skull, I look at some of these geniuses who have to go in for electroshock therapy and think, eh, I'll live with a little dumb and happy. Anyway, back to the show.
Direction, trying to unite, trying to do a lot of what we're talking about here. He's identified that there's classic quality, which is, you know, the more rational, the mechanical, the rational, and then there's romantic, which is aesthetics. And so as he's trying to he realizes that if you're just looking at things in these polar opposites, like you were saying, polarization, you're not going to get the full picture. You can explain most of the world with the subject object way of looking at things, but you're not going to explain these ephemeral qualities that you have in romantic quality. So he makes a really big breakthrough when he discovers the mathematician Poincaré. And Poincaré is where, you know, looking, like we said, now there's all these facts, and now even we have even more because the internet introduces just, you know, an explosion of facts. And these facts will present themselves, and you don't know which ones are right. So say you're working on something, and you care about this project, but you don't know what the next step is, and you can't just observe everything objectively and figure it out. You have to care. You have to have this essential state of wanting it to be better. And so
Now here again, that wanting, that's that value, that's that. You know, that's something they didn't build it in the factory, the Takeya factory, in their 40-ounce insulated water bottle that Paul Vanderclay picked up at Costco in Sacramento, California. 2 bottles for like $21. Great deal, did I mention? Costco, where's my product? You know, where's my affiliate status for Costco? I'm there every weekend. I'm listening to Vervaeke as I'm walking through the Costco in Elk Grove. So, but the value, the wanting, and a little bit, Peugeot's going to put that together. I can't wait on this. I can't wait on this business about God and person, because if you've been watching my videos, you know that's what I'm. The more I listen to conversations. And I've been wanting to put together a video about this for a while, and I keep having to put together other videos before I do it, and it's continuing to gel. There's this very interesting conversations with 3 guys, and I mentioned this before, about how they're just asking this. There's not really enough room for randomness to have created the universe, and that's a huge problem. It's like, well, why is that a huge problem? Well, it's a huge problem because if it's not randomness, then there's some intentionality to put together the universe. Well, why is that a huge problem? Because if there's intentionality that put together the universe, that intentionality has ideas about what I should and shouldn't do. There is an obligation built into existence. And there might even be a lot more than an obligation. There might be a judgment day, and there might be expectations, and there might be all of these things. And so what I watch is that this resistance we have to God. Well, I don't think this is hard to figure out. This is basically what Thomas Nagel says, and I don't have the quote, and this is what happens when I make a video without making a PowerPoint first. But Thomas Nagel says it's picked up in a Tim Keller book, and it's picked up by Alvin Plantinga, but he basically says, I don't want there to be a God, because if there's a God, then someone has expectations and intentions and actually obliges me to think and to do and behave in a certain way, and I really darn it like my freedom. And I don't want that. And I think part of the reason why, as the materialist worldview continues to disintegrate, continues to just plain fall apart under the weight of evidence and the whispers in the universe that we have been resisting. Read Romans 1. This is what we suppress, Paul says, in our hearts. We resist this stuff because we don't want it to be true. Well, why don't we want it to be true? Well, because what if there is a person? And this gets into my conversations with Nathan Jacobs, too. And we're going to have another one a little bit later this month. And also John Vervaeke and someone else coming on this week that some of you might find interesting. So more conversations to follow and also more regular conversations as I've opened that up a bit. And yeah, they're all full, but some more will open up. So be patient. Leave room for first timers. Anyway, we like to phrase it in impersonal ways. And this is where it gets into the spirit of finesse and the spirit of geometry that what I talked about Pascal. You see, the way you deal with the spirit of finesse is you try a little something and it comes back. And you try a little something and it comes back. And you try a little something and it comes back. And when it comes to personality, this is exactly how we want to be treated. Because when we're treated as geometry, we rebel. Because it's not geometry from the inside. Why do you treat me as if it's geometry? You see, I didn't even finish getting dressed this morning. Boy, what a slob. Anyway, where was I going? Geometry and finesse. Well, we treat the world that's too big to know as finesse. And that's exactly the proper way to deal with it. It's exactly the proper way to deal with personhood. Now, a little bit later in this video with Jonathan and Sevilla, I'm such a sucker for book mentions, so I ordered that book that she posted because it's like Peugeot's been talking about this stuff. I've been trying to get it through my thick skull, and I think I'm finally getting it through my thick skull. But, you know, understanding what a personality is and understanding that what a person is actually all of these sub-personalities, the many and the one. You can listen to Barron and Peterson talk about that. You have the many and the one is actually integrating, again, all of these sub-personalities, getting it into a cohesive whole. Well, what is the difference when everything is put together into a cohesive whole? Well, the difference is that there is actually a center to that whole. And that is exactly, that is actually the agent where, well, I can be the angry man, or I can be the jealous man, or I can be the rational man, or I can be the loving man, or I can be the passionate man, or I can be all of these things, but they're all integrated. And what happens mysteriously, again, oh, so mysteriously, even within us, is that there's somehow way down deep inside an agent and a chooser. And when we're not treated like we're an agent and a chooser, when someone treats us with the spirit of geometry, boy, do we not like it. Boy, are we angry. We'll burn down the house over something like that. Why? Because we know that something in us has been violated. Okay? And now, and so this is where we go with this. So an ontology of quality or an ontology of value. See, I think part of the reason we want to say value instead of God is that when we look at value, something in our heart suspects, I can treat that with the spirit of geometry. I understand what value is, and we probably don't, but it's just a little word. And part of what happens with, if you're a Christian for a long time too, is sometimes you look at that little word God and think, well, I understand what God is. Well, all the theologians have forever been saying, no, you really don't. But you should probably understand a little more than you do understand. But when we have value or something like that, or if it's just psychology, well, then we can approach it with this spirit of mathematics. And now I can discern it. And now I can take this other human being and turn them into an object. I can turn them into a water bottle. And I can rip any value off it and place my own values on it. This is the story of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This is the story of Lord of the Rings. This is how many stories that people look to dominate. And I've been thinking a lot about the word violate because I watched the Eric Weinstein, Peter Thiel, the first Portal. I thought that was a really good conversation. And And the second half of it was better than the first half of it, because sometimes it takes a little while to get a conversation going. And actually, in this video, even though I'm playing the first half of the conversation, the second half might even be better because they get a little bit sharper. And boy, they talk about some really important things towards the end there. It was really, really good. But one of the things that I noticed with Peter Thiel is he keeps talking about violating. And I thought, and right away I thought in the back of my mind, I got to do a little bit of Owen Barfield on that word violate. And I got to see if the word violate is in the Bible. And you might say, oh, just pick up a concordance and see if violate is in the Bible. No, I got to look at the Hebrew and the Greek, and I got to look at that concept, because violation is something like, you know, some of you have been responding to my plow sermon, my rough draft for Sunday sermon. And I mean, violation is that something, some shalom has been, you know, the reason we use it in sexual references for rape is something has entered me and taken something from me that an illicit agent has done so. It's so funny how we're so quick to get rid of agency for things that we think we can manage. But then when we've been violated, boy, we're ready to ascribe agency all over the map. So back to the value thing here. So we so often want to take that which, let's say, in theology has a person, and we want to make it an object. And I think part of this, and I want to really think a lot more about this later, I think part of this is because in modernity, we have taken on a feature of our social status structures of, we have an overactive, Peterson in his conversation with Matt Dillahunty talks about our overactive agency detector. Sometimes we detect agency where we shouldn't. So we get a tax bill from the government and we say, ah, they've been watching me, or something comes up. Google's been reading my email. Ah, there's a conspiracy against me. And we're so ready to go and do that. And that's why I say we're so willing to attribute agency to the negative side, and we don't want to attribute it to the positive side, because I think we want to be at the top of the hierarchy. So in modernity, this overactive agency detector, we kind of realize that. And so we've compensated on the other side and say, yeah, weather, that's, you know, And in fact, now we've done it to the whole skies. There is no agent up in the sky. Oh, okay. But it's still way more complicated than we can imagine. And really, the default human mode that we use to engage with something more complex than we can master. In other words, to rightly opt for the esprit de finesse. See, I got my Spanish. I don't know French, so I Spanishize my French. The spirit of finesse instead of the spirit of geometry. And this is why we say, well, that's more art than science. Well, as we should. Well, again, naturally, and I think rightly, we, in a sense, personify that which is greater. And so then we have to approach it in that way. And when we deal with people with the spirit of geometry rather than the spirit of finesse, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, go and see my video that I did talking about Pascal. If we're looking at it with the spirit of geometry rather than the spirit of finesse, we're doing it wrongly. Yeah, go ahead and treat your significant, any significant other in that way, and see how well that goes. Peterson is dead on right with that point. But I think part of the reason we implicitly want to, because we implicitly want to depersonalize the universe, is this is a motivated decision. We want to do it because that leaves us in charge. Now, once we've reduced it to the spirit of geometry, now we can have control. We're all little Saurons in the making.
Poincaré found that when he's working on a mathematical problem, there's what you would say a quality detector in, this is his theory.
Mm-hmm. There's a quality detector. That's right. This is the Newman. This is probably something like the numinous. And if you look at the beginning of C.S. Lewis's Problem of Pain or the idea of the holy, this is another sense we have. It's the sense of the numinous. And we know that there's value out there and we sense it, even though it's not one of these five materialist senses we have. Got way more, baby.
In pre-intellectual awareness, you know, before conscious, like consciousness but unconscious.
Yeah.
And in that pre-intellectual awareness, that's where quality makes itself known to you. You don't actually have a will. You can't.
Now listen to the language. Quality makes itself known to you. That's the language of agency. But we have this modernist disposition to demythologize it and say, we, spirit of finesse, we kind of have to deal with it with the spirit of finesse, because again, it's not flat to it's not explained. Remember, explain is to flatten it out and lay it out all before us, so we have mastery over it in a way. It's a detector and we know it, but we don't dare say it, and we don't dare say it in front of each other. And that's why people shut up and they only tell their pastors when they have spooky experiences. Ooh, that's too woo for me to talk about. But we see it all the time, and then, oh, we don't talk about that in public.
I mean,
yeah.
Well, let me go into it in a second. But in there, the next quality step kind of presents itself, and then that comes into awareness.
Yeah. So it's a form of intuition. I mean, it's the click.
Right.
It's the aha, you know,
it's the click. It's the aha. Yes. But even more than that, it's like an essential quality is an eternal thing that comes up to you. You know, it's always.
I mean, it's so funny when I listen to her talk in this video, it's like, you just slap God in for that. And gosh, you're part of the way there.
Present, and it comes up to you in that subliminal state. And then you'll detect the right facts there if you are caring about it.
Conscience.
If that's what you want. You know, you can't just like sit back and wait for it. And so...
Jonathan smiles. I wonder, are you thinking what I'm thinking here, John?
So there's a quote here. The difference between a good mechanic and a bad one, like the difference between a good mathematician and a bad one, is precisely the ability to select the good facts from the bad ones.
And all of the latest videos from John Vervaeke on the salience and the relevance, and boy, that's been good. That series has gotten so good with the last 5-8 videos.
On the basis of quality, he has to care. Mm-hmm. This is an ability about which formal traditional scientific method has nothing to say. It has, you know, it has no room for value.
Yeah.
So the last part, I think is the most important, is there's a metaphor in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance of the train. So there's a train that is known as knowledge, and the train is classical knowledge. It's rational knowledge that's represented by the engine and the boxcars and everything that's in the boxcars. That's everything, the sum total of human experience plus your own understanding of that. Everything you've learned so far, your innate biological traits. You're not going to see romantic knowledge. So if you look at the train, you're not going to see the romantic part. So this is materialism, but romantic knowledge is the leading edge of the train.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going to keep the train going, and it's going to keep the train going on the track of quality.
Mm-hmm.
And without this ephemeral thing that can't be measured by science, you know, nothing's going to work. So this is the stimulus. Quality is the stimulus, and what is valuable propels the train forward.
Hmm.
So the romantic quality is the leading edge of experience that keeps the train on track. The boxcars are the collective memory of where the train has been, and the leading edge tells us where to go. So, and that leading edge is right in the moment.
Huh.
So the structure of the future is selected pre-intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
The structure of the future. What is the future? I mean, listen to a bunch of Jordan Peterson stuff on the future.
And you could say that pre-intellectual selection is kind of like what you were saying about God's will, because value is the predecessor of structure, not the other way around. And the manner...
And let me, again, slow this. Value is the predecessor of structure. Value says, I was just talking, you know, there needs to be a bridge here. That value is the predecessor of the bridge. It's the whole idea behind markets. You know, this stuff is just built into everything. And, you know, again, materialism, the reason it's falling apart is like, it's a water bottle. Well, you can't even say that.
And this is what you said, the manner in which the infinite encounters the particular. So that's that pre-intellectual awareness encountering the next thing, and that thing will specify into what's needed.
Now I'm getting another piece, the thing that I wanted to talk about, the Mark Vernon, Malcolm Guite video on, is a big part of my thinking about this, is the question, okay, what about materiality? So we have all of these ideas and you have this value. And then the question is, why a water bottle at all? Well, not really a water bottle, because again, the value brings the water bottle into existence via marketplaces and technology and engineering and engineers and all that kind of stuff. The value brings the water bottle into existence. But why stuff? Why particularity? And again, I think I'm going to have a lot to say about this in the next few weeks, I hope, because it's all been running around in my mind. And if I had to put it in one word, I'd say glory. That's why. It's glory. Because it's the transmission of glory. But once you have the possibility for the transmission of glory, you have the possibility for the transmission of the opposite of glory. Which, boy, that gets complicated. But it's glory. And this is where the mystical, this is the limits of the mystical. Because another video that's in the video I was going to make today, but didn't have time to make, and I'm using time. Look, I don't have a lot of time. I'm running out of time. But the video I was going to make today, talking about why don't we, if our friend is wasting their life, like Jordan Peterson has, on the sofa covered in Cheeto dust playing video games all the time, why do we call that a waste of their life? Even if they're staying in the flow state and in the video game world, they're on top of the hierarchy and we have no value for that. Why? It's because of the water bottle. It's because of stuff. It's because of glory. And because we know, well, you know, that's kind of like, and it's the same reason that we have no more monasteries today. We look at a monastery and we say, what's it for? Why? What's the relationship between that and the Protestant Reformation? Everything. But now we're getting to the point of saying, well, maybe we should have a monastery or two. And you have all these Protestants sneaking into monasteries now and saying, well, this is kind of cool. This is kind of important. But hey, your ancestors destroyed the monasteries and now you're sneaking in. What's happening with that? Well, we're going to have to talk a lot more about that. But I'm distracted. I'm ADHD. I can't help it. It's my lack of personhood. Here we go.
And like you said, it's going to look like it's our will, but it's really this quality showing us what it is.
People and persons, how many of this are there?
It's interesting. What's interesting is that I'm interested in curious about the fact that he uses the word romantic.
Ah, yeah. And my favorite Vervaeke video is this romanticism video, okay? Because Vervaeke basically says what happened in the romantic period is that, well, I probably intuitively they began to realize that, I can't say it like John does, I thought John laid it out really well, but something huge was left behind. And so now we have this facsimile that we put forward, and actually there's a real relationship between romanticism and various forms of idolatry. Now it's all about romantic love, or it's all about the family. And you know, you find churches getting suckered into this. Every time I hear a pastor say, it's all about family, I think, yeah, you should, you know, that should get you in real trouble. Just like my friend whose video I'll play, you know, having problem with the Trinity. Saying it's all about family, that's about as idolatrous as a whole bunch of other things. So what's with the romanticism? I think it's because in this framework, this is what so many are simply left with. It was such a powerful movement. Oops. Play.
Just mention of pre-intellectual in the sense of trance. It's actually the word in Greek is nous, which actually is intellect, but it's intellect in the sense of direct intuition of what is,
real,
you know, and that's different from the kind of the kind of wispy feeling that you get in the what I noticed to be kind of the romantic sense of this kind of sentimental ebb and flow, all of that is that I would put that below the thought rational. So you have, I mean, this is like traditional Christian,
right,
you know, ontology. So you have the nous, mm-hmm, which is above. Then you have the thoughts, the will, all mm-hmm of this kind of the thing that we consider consciousness would be below that. And then below that, you would have the desiring quality and the irascible quality. Mm-hmm. So that all the emotions, all the pulls, all of that would be kind of this bubbling thing underneath, you know. So in a way, there's the unconscious. In normal psychology, it was almost like the unconscious would be this below thing, but then you have supra consciousness, mm-hmm, which is not, I don't see it framed a lot in modern. Yeah.
And it isn't framed a lot because we have a problem with other persons and because we have this bias about agency. And so that's in a sense what secularism is. It's a bias against agency above us. Other minds besides the ones that are walking around between like all of this stuff that we're used to recognizing. Unless they're aliens, and then suddenly we're, you know, oh, I can believe that.
Modern way of thinking. It's not the same as the unconscious in the sense of these secret desires and all these secret pulls that you have. But it's actually something above, which is this kind of intuitive grasp that you can have.
Yeah.
So I don't know if Persig talks about this difference or for him it's the same. Like, let's say the romantic part or the wispy kind of connection to that aspect, to the belly, to all that stuff, is different from the top part, let's say. I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm trying to...
No, it does make sense. But what he does is he changes the terminology in the second book.
Okay.
So he...
Now I got to read another book.
He changes it from romantic quality to dynamic quality. And he changes classical quality to static patterns.
Okay.
So it's this dynamic quality, which is in the pre-intellectual. And that, like the train metaphor, he uses classic and romantic, so I used it there. But in Lila, he changes it to, you know, the second book where he really, you know, codifies the theory. He changes it to this dynamic quality, and that's what was going to be detected in the pre-intellectual. And that dynamic quality, you're in the static patterns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the static patterns in the metaphysics of quality very much are like in your brother's book, this here, mm-hmm, you know, this with the inorganic on the bottom, mm-hmm, and then it's biological, then it's social, and then it's intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
So it's similar to that. I mean, not exactly the same, but it's a very similar hierarchical structure. And so these patterns, and they can be of any of the four, the dynamic quality acts on these.
See, and when she said that, I'm just too much of a Bible reader to let the Greeks kind of get away with that hierarchy in some ways, because again, of what I think the role of the material world is in the narrative. And again, Christian churches get this wrong all the time. And I regularly hear Christian people say, well, the gospel is believing in Jesus and then you go to heaven when you die. And it's like N.T. Wright takes a big swipe at that one. And it's like, well, if that was the case, the resurrection wouldn't make any sense. There's a reason Jesus comes back and eats a fish and says, Thomas, touch the hand, dude. Put the hand in my side. Something important is going on here. There's a reason there's an ascension, even though Jesus seemed to just kind of pop in and out. It's like, we're going to do the ascension thing because you need to know the narrative. And the narrative has everything to do with glory and stuff through our thick heads.
Is to transform them. Mm-hmm. And so it's not it's not romantic in that sense. It's dynamic in the sense that you have things that are stable,
mm-hmm,
and this is the transformative agent. Let's just say.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean,
and the transformative agent again. This is why Jesus' miracles are so foundational, and they communicate so cross-culturally. And I just last Sunday school. I really should be posting my Sunday school my Sunday school lessons on time, because not anywhere near enough of you are watching my Sunday school lessons, because it's, I'm working out all of this stuff as I talk to this class, none of whom are watching any of the videos. And what I have to do is translate all of this stuff into language that eight senior citizens from my church can understand. It's all the same stuff I'm putting out, but I have to work it through right now. The Gospel of John. And when Jesus turns water into wine, that's this entire transformation. Well, why doesn't Jesus turn water into the idea of wine? No, because wine is this transmitter of glory. That's what it's for. And that the materiality, the instantiation, the stuffness, the matterness matters. And that's why we're not Gnostics. And that's why when Jesus does a miracle, they say he's the Son of God. Why? Because he's got mastery over this. And why we're so impressed with ourselves when we can make a water bottle that's so darn good and economical that you can buy at Costco and Elk Grove for like $22 for two of them. Endorsement, right? What do they call that? Affiliate thing? Anyway, that's what's going on with this stuff.
I mean, it's interesting. I guess I should probably at some point actually just read the book. I have.
No, Jonathan, you got to read two.
I have a secret thing, which is my. It's not a secret. I guess people probably have figured it out by now.
And you're not alone. We all have biases. Not all of them are good. Not all of them are bad either.
A certain aversion to this kind of California Buddhism.
Why does California get a bad name for it? Yeah, we all know why. Anyway, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because. Yeah, this is true. And
I call it part of motorcycle mania. A book and to judge a philosophy just by its title, and because I have this weird thing about people using Buddhism as a deconstructive agent, actually, you know, like.
And I think actually that bias is part of. I actually love what Peugeot says there, as a deconstructive agent, because they're trying to break free of, let's say, Christianity, and so they need something, and so whatever low-hanging fruit idea about Buddhism becomes a knife. And so it's so funny because I watch California, because I'm in California, I watch all these California Buddhists, and they're like, yeah, I'm so into Buddhism, but I really want that new car. And it's like, yeah, whatever happened to the noble truths? Whatever happened to that the source of your suffering is your desire? And you go into these amazing houses where people have been working their butts off and made all this money, and they all these little heads of Buddha all over the houses. And I think I actually did a sermon on this once. I mean, can you have a statue of Buddha in your bathroom? What does that say? You would not want to have Jesus by your urinal. We went all through that with art back in the 70s, but you got all these disembodied heads of Buddha all over these enormously priced houses, and it's like there's something psychological going on there, something archetypal.
Yeah. They're using the foreign something outside of their own tradition and culture to mm-hmm. wreck their own thing. You know, it's a normal move. You know, it was there. The Romans did the same. You know, the young people would dress as barbarians. As the barbarians were at the gate, you know, coming in. So it's like you use something the outside to demolish your thing. So hopefully I can get over that little thing, read the book.
Well, I think actually a lot of people didn't read it for that reason.
Oh, really?
And as you know,
I didn't read it for that reason. I confess.
In the 70s, as people read it, they realized, wow, this isn't about Zen at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's. I mean, it is, you know, but it's not what they thought it would be. It's really going back into Western philosophy and figuring out where the problem was,
mm-hmm.
and kind of revivifying.
And see, that's just it. When I keep talking about we're haunted by a telos. Well, we know there's a problem, so we got to figure out where the problem is. But we keep figuring out what the problem is, and we don't have a solution because we're not masters of this. We're just people. And together we're a whole lot more than we are by ourselves, but yeah.
Taking that and using that to revivify our a new philosophy for the new age, which I think is similar to you know, John Vervaeke's going back and to the ancient Greeks and looking for, and other philosophers and looking for a direction there. And if, and it seems to me that that Eastern Orthodoxy is bringing back an old practice into the modern age. Mm-hmm. So there's a similarity there, I think.
Yeah. Well, for sure. There's the, yeah. I mean, it's funny because what I'm saying has absolutely nothing to do with actual Buddhism. Like, mm-hmm. if I read Zen texts, I get a lot from them. And I've read some really, you know, if I read a series of koans, for example, like I mm-hmm. find them extremely powerful. And so and I think it's obvious that it's inevitable to notice the resemblance between mindfulness and remembrance of God or you know, remembrance of sin in that you find in the hesychastic practice. It's very similar. So obviously it's inevitable to see the resemblances. So yeah. So like I said, a lot of my reaction might not be as profound as I, you know, it's more just it's almost like a social problem that, mm-hmm. that I see rather than an actual philosophical problem. And so,
yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so how do you see, let's say, so in terms of, because I've seen you're doing a lot of stuff on Persig, and mm-hmm. then you're kind of looking, watching John's lectures, following Paul and myself. And so mm-hmm. How do you see these things kind of coming together? How do you see them connecting in the different way? Because you have your own very particular perception about John's work mm-hmm. and my work and all that. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that for people who also, even for people who haven't watched the video that you put out. By the way, there are two videos that she did trying to connect some of these mm-hmm. ideas together. I'll probably put them in the description for those who want to get a little bit more of that.
Well, I think that my goal in all of this is to actually be able to practice it in the world. Mm. You know, not just as a therapist.
Now, that's a really key thing. And the way she said it, to practice it in the world. And this is exactly why we're not Gnostics, and why when Jesus turns water to wine, we call him the Son of God, but then later forget that the disciples saw that and then didn't believe. That's how flaky we are. But we want to practice it in the world because somehow we know that this is power and this is mastery. And so this ambitious part of us wells up, but again, a fully integrated person, well, actually that fully integrated person, this is where we, you know, Christian language, a fully integrated person is formed by Christ and becomes Christ and becomes becomes Christ on the spot. That's the goal in Christianity. And I know, you know, I sometimes hear the way Jordan would sometimes talk about, well, Orthodoxy is about, well, that's about transformation. It's like, what? Protestantism isn't? Roman Catholicism isn't? Christianity is about transformation. It's about becoming the likeness of Christ, becoming part of Christ. If you look at the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels have the kingdom of God, and the Gospel of John has eternal life, but the Apostle Paul has being in Christ. And it's like, well, I become one of those sub-personalities within the coherent personality that is Christ. That's Christianity.
But my own personal journey, because I think we really, as you're saying, as we come to the end of this cycle, as everything's kind of falling apart, as everything is so superficial, fragmented, what are we going to do to readhere that? And I think,
and again, what's so nice about the way she said that is that's so boundaryless. What are we? Who's the we? What are we? It's all of us. And we feel it in our families, in our nation, in our cities, in our communities. We feel it in all. We feel the whole thing coming apart at the same time. And how is it going to recohere? And we're actually all working on that. And that's why people, indifference to the plight of your neighbor is not a virtue. neither is enmeshment in the drama of your neighbor. And so figuring out exactly how that works, well, that's an important thing.
That all of us, you know, you, all of us here in this corner are trying to do that, are trying to figure out a way, a philosophical way of being in the world that can manage what's going on, that can manage all this fragmentation. And I think fragmentation is a beautiful way of putting it. And so, so John is looking at a variety of practices, and you and Paul already have established Christian practices, which, you know, work beautifully. And I think that for me, it's sort of to follow you and to understand what you're doing sort of gives me ideas of what is the next direction. And is the next direction going to be something secular, or is it going to be something where I do, in fact, turn around and start believing in God? And I
right there, I mean, the way she set it up was so right in terms of this place we now are at in the West. Secularity was developed by people for a reason. And in many ways, it developed in the West because of the ongoing wars that the Protestant Reformation yielded. Now those who are talking about the violence in the Islamic world say something like, well, they need a Protestant Reformation. You know, I can understand the analogy, but the time and the issues are by no means the same. What they're really talking about is we have this imagination that we have all this abstract theological stuff over here, which is indifferent to the things down below. That's, in a sense, the nature of secularity. And as the world gets increasingly secular, now notice this with the Verveke Meaning Crisis video, why is it in the secular world that we are having all of these meaning problems? Well, no coincidence. And in fact, that's what this whole conversation about the meaning crisis is about. That's what this whole move is. Well, we got rid of Christianity because it was problematic. And then you have Douglas Murray. Well, maybe being without Christianity is more problematic. Well, what do we do? And then the question is, well, can we make a new one? Well, I don't know. Making the old one was pretty costly, especially for the dude on the cross. And that resurrection thing? Yeah, you pull that off. We're in a bind. And I think she articulates that well. And I love where this conversation goes for the next few minutes.
I don't mean to put that as superficially as it sounds. Because
and Jonathan giggles because it's
because
it's not superficial. It's exactly the right word.
It's turning around because the problem with this is I don't know, and I don't know how you feel about this. I don't know if you can sort of fake it till you make it. I don't know what happens in those terms, because it seems to me that I have this innate sense that unless I truly feel it with the entirety of my being, unless a person feels it with the entirety of their being, it's somehow counterfeit.
Jonathan's answer here is so good.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I think that one of the problems with Christianity in general is that you also don't want to confuse the beginning of the road and the end of the road, right? It's if you could completely inhabit it with your entire being, then you would already be a saint, and so then you know, you'd be fine. So I think that we
and P.S. none of us are doing it that good either. There's a little bit fake it till you make it in this here pastor in Sacramento, and I don't want to put Jonathan on the spot, but I guess it's true of him.
We have to be careful not to look to find illumination before we just actually enter onto the path of, you know, up at the bottom of the mountain.
Now he used the term illumination. I would get back to what we were talking about and what you will talk about. Boy, I feel like, you know, I know the future of this conversation. When you talk about what a personality is, because it's one that coheres and we're formed in Christ. And, you know, when I meet with people and they're struggling with their own sin, the people who actually I have hope for are the ones who struggle with their own sin and can actually do that with someone else. And as a pastor, I'm often in that role. They're struggling with their own sin. It's like, can it cohere? Because they say, well, I don't think I'm a Christian because I did this. And I'd say, no, you're a Christian because you noticed. And you noticed that that was outside of this formation that you're being formed into. And if you actually work the process of bringing that into the formation, well, you're going to be a powerful person. You're going to be put together. You're going to know some stuff. You're going to know when. This is, I love the Verveke salient stuff. You know, you're going to know. It's not just knowing stuff. It's knowing the moment. It's the skill and the timing. And it's all of those things. That's the moment.
Also, but at the same time, you don't also want to pretend, in the sense you don't want to lie to yourself, which would not be appropriate. But there, you know, I think that you might not need as much as you think to kind of start the journey.
And that is, I mean, the classic example, the thief on the cross. What's great about that is 1 minute he and the other thief are mocking on Jesus, like, ah, you putz, you're up here on a cross with us, you loser. And then one thief gets a different idea. How he sees that. That makes me a Calvinist. How he sees that. And he recognizes, and Jesus says, today you'll be with me in paradise. It's like, what? What? No communion, no baptism. Bang! Right there. How much sanctification did that other naked guy on the cross have? Not much. God can do stuff.
And so what is your, in terms of the notion of, maybe what is your, a little, tell me a little bit of your story. Did you?
You should have watched my video with her. Let's see.
You know, there's a lot of trouble. And of being Episcopal, mm-hmm. really kind of.
So she's going to church.
And so I think that they kind of pulled back.
And I don't know how much of the more of this is going to play because I'm running out of time. But, and I don't want to, you know, I say that a little flippantly. Yeah, she's going to church or she's visiting church. And all of this stuff gets into all of these questions of, well, what do you do in church? Why do you go to church? And what does that have to do with persons? And it has to deal with, once you decide you're going to treat God, even if you're not quite sure, as a person, you're going to respect it in that way, just like you respect other people. You're going to try and engage, and you're going to try and get in alignment and have that formation. And, you know, this is where a lot of the mysteries begin. And, So, yeah, watch the whole video. The whole thing was great. And maybe I'll make another video out of the other hour of it, who knows, but I was just so inspired and blown away by this conversation that I had to make a video. So I hope the sound quality was okay. I hope, you know, sometimes I think about my channel, I just think I'm the biggest jerk out there, because here these wonderful people are having sweet conversations on the internet, and look at the size of this nose. I just get that beak right in the middle of it and put in my 2 cents, and the sound's all messed up, and who asked me anyway? And then I get comments. My favorite comments are the comments like, I wanted to listen to the video and you kept interrupting. And I say, you could listen to the original, because I don't talk in that one, which is why I'm a Budinsky, and why I, well, that's probably not nice to the Slavic nations. But anyway, watch the video. It's really good stuff. And I'm busy this week. I'm too darn busy. I want to make more videos, but anyway, watch it.